Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the separate narratives coming out of St. Louis, Missouri, one from the grand jury rigged in favor of Officer Wilson, who was allowed to testify, then, with the major networks begging for exclusive interviews, was allowed to present the official narrative. While on the other hand, the victim, who is unable to speak, is put on trial, leaving those who support justice and racial equality angry and frustrated. Clarissa Haywood, a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis and author of How Americans Make Race, joins us to discuss the possibility of bridging the gap in the racially divided city of St. Louis that has a long history of racial violence and segregated communities. Then we will look into the provocative actions taken by Vladimir Putin, who is sending aircraft to buzz NATO facilities and submarines into neutral waters with the apparent aim of provoking a military incident to further inflame the Russian people, who are told the West is out to humiliate, if not destroy them. Kimberly Martin, a professor of political science at Barnard College and author of Warlords, Strong-Arm Brokers in Weak States, joins us to discuss her article at the Huffington Post, Don't Prop Up Putin by Giving Him an Enemy, and whether, with hawks like Senator McCain taking over in the Senate, the U.S. will be pressured into taking the bait and arming Ukraine, which will play into Putin's narrative and bring a new Cold War closer to reality. Then finally, we will discuss Republican plans to give $400 billion in permanent tax breaks to big corporations at the expense of helping the middle class and working Americans who have seen jobs return but not wages. Rebecca Smith, the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, joins us to discuss how the 1% have won at the national level, but at the local level, the 99% are organizing to raise the minimum wages and stop the Walmarting of America so that American families can have a livable wage and be able to celebrate Thanksgiving instead of working for low wages so that Walmart can make even greater profits on Black Friday. And joining us now is Clarissa Haywood, a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis, whose research and teaching focuses on questions central to understanding and evaluating political life. She's the author of How Americans Make Race. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clarissa Haywood.
Thank you. It's nice to talk with you again.
And in terms of how Americans make race and how we have these two different narratives now that have come out of the grand jury's decision not to indict the officer who shot Michael Brown, and clearly there are people who believe the district attorney, even though it seems pretty obvious that the whole system was rigged. He allowed the officer to testify in the grand jury instead of prosecuting him or indicting him. He basically gave him an opportunity to sway the grand jurors as though they were putting Michael Brown on trial. And thus, his narrative about what happened, which was he was able to present on ABC News after all the news anchors in the country came, you know, hat in hand, begging him to be on so that they give him free airtime. So it seems that that's on the one side. And on the other side, you have anger and outrage amongst the parents throughout the entire African-American community around the country and around the world, for that matter. So there seems to be two very distinct narratives here. Do you see a time or a way or a means that these narratives can be bridged?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I think you're right about the two different narratives, and I think a lot of the survey research coming out over the past few months has shown widely divergent perceptions and opinions between African-American and white Americans. In terms of the statement that we heard from McCullough and the interview by Darren Wilson, I think a big piece of the outrage is that what African-Americans and what Michael Brown's family have been asking and hoping for is simply a trial. So a lot of the outrage surrounds the fact that we don't even get to have a public trial. Instead, we had a secret behind closed doors grand jury decision with a tremendous perception of illegitimacy among those in the Black community. In terms of bridging that divide, it's a very difficult question because we have different sets of beliefs that are reinforced by different narratives that come from the media and also from the government. So it's a really challenging issue, and I think, if anything, we have a greater divide now than we did back in August.
Well, in terms of the government, where you have an African-American president and an African-American attorney general, neither of whom seem to want to sort of step out or step up and defend the Michael Brown narrative, not so much his actions, but what happened to him and the outrage that somebody could be exonerated in with so little clarity about what actually happened, and we have to rely on this other narrative that was created by the policeman and the who shot the young man and the prosecutor. I take it that what's happening here is that President Obama has sort of been a little burned by what when he brings up race, particularly when his friend was arrested by the Cambridge police in Massachusetts for entering his own home. Remember, he had to have that little beer summit to sort of calm things down. So what's your opinion about both Holder and Obama? Should they have stepped up more, or should they step up more, or do you understand how every time they do try to step up, at least Obama, he gets slammed?
You know, I do think he should have stepped up more. Obama is a second-term president. He, I think, is in a position where he's able to make a bolder move. I think the African-American community has really looked to him for leadership on some of these issues and has been terribly disappointed. His announcement or his press conference following the announcement by McCullough struck many people as tone-deaf. He was simply not addressing the main issues. Maybe he was burned following his statements after Skip Gates was arrested trying to enter his own home in Cambridge. But I think that part of the role of a leader is to be willing to absorb criticism and to stand up to it. And I think Obama in particular has really failed to address the issues that Ferguson has brought to light, you know, in the past 4 months and especially the other night. It was a very disappointing press conference that he gave.
Well, I saw the press conference, I think it was on MSNBC, where it was juxtaposed. Half the screen was the president. And the other half of the screen were tear gas and rioting and burning in Ferguson. So that certainly could have actually played against him in the sense that whatever he said looks trivial compared to what you're watching on the other side of the screen.
I think one of the issues is that he has repeatedly raised the problem of violence, and it hasn't been even-handed. So it's true. It's absolutely true that in Ferguson we've seen violence from arsonists and looters. We've also seen a large number of peaceful protesters. And I will just say as a side comment that in a lot of the media, there's been a conflation of protesters with rioters. These are not the same people. But President Obama addressed the violence, but it felt very one-sided because much of the violence, including much of the excessive, over-the-top, and unwarranted violence, not just in Ferguson but throughout the St. Louis area, has come from police. And that was the case in August, and it was the case in the past few days. And I think he's right that violence is not a constructive response, but certainly violence from law enforcement is not a constructive response. And one of the questions that many people have raised and that I've not heard a satisfactory answer to is if there was such a concern with preventing violence, why all the leaks? Why the long buildup and then an announcement at night? You know, why not make this inflammatory, in my opinion, announcement from McCullough at 9 o'clock in the morning? So it's true that violence is a problem. I think it's absolutely wrongheaded to point fingers at protesters.
Again, I'm speaking with Clarissa Haywood, who's a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis, whose research and teaching focuses on questions central to understanding and evaluating political life. She's the author of How Americans Make Race. So I guess having the first African-American president and the first African-American attorney general, maybe it's worked against race relations in as much as people think, race issues are over now that we've shown as a nation that we are so mature in that regard. Do you find that the possibility of that being an irony?
I do, actually. I think you've really hit the nail on the head. A lot of Americans, a lot of white Americans, have taken the election of Obama and, of course, the appointment of the Attorney General to signify that we've achieved a colorblind state, that we've achieved racial justice and racial equality. And I think that in some ways, this makes people who have a predisposition to want to believe that's the case complacent, you know, feel that our work is done in terms of achieving racial justice in this country. So in some ways, it is counterproductive in the sense that it makes many racially privileged Americans think, well, we're done. We don't need to talk about this any longer.
So what is it about your city, though, Clarissa Hayward, St. Louis, that supposedly in the north, it's not in the south, obviously, and it's sort of a purple state. You have a mm-hmm. Democratic governor and a Democratic senator, but clearly McCulloch and company, I think, are Republicans, are they not?
That's right. No, McCulloch's a Democrat.
McCulloch's a Democrat, is he? Oh.
Yeah.
You also have a history of racial violence going back decades and certainly even centuries. I mean, for example, I was reading the other day a book about, of all things, the Nazi occupation of Paris, and it mentioned the famous expatriate African-American Josephine Baker, who was a spy for the Allies during the war and also worked with the French resistance. She escaped to Paris because of racism here in the United States. But when she was a young girl growing up in St. Louis, her house was burned out, as were the neighborhood. Mm. You know, she was burned out of her own home. And
right.
So explain that to me. There's got to be racism in that city's DNA by the sound of it.
Right, right. I think that's a very poignant way to put it. St. Louis has an incredibly long and horrible history of racial discrimination. So, for example, it was one of the few cities in America that actually had a racial zoning ordinance. It passed a racial zoning ordinance telling African Americans where they could not live in the city. It's the place where the Shelley v. Kramer trial originated, which was the trial that eventually rendered or ruled that racially restrictive covenants were unenforceable. That was over a St. Louis case. So we've had a very long history of racial discrimination in housing, in employment, in schooling. After the 1960s, when these explicitly racist laws were taken off the books, what happened is that because of this long history, this long geography, and institutional structure, we ended up with a very structurally racist system in St. Louis. So today, for example, I would just quote, I think this statistic has been quoted quite a lot, but I think it's worth reminding ourselves of. St. Louis metropolitan area has almost 400 independent autonomous local municipalities. Ferguson is one of them. And so it's often pointed to as a very fragmented city. Because of this long history of racial discrimination, we have economic inequality that's clearly racially patterned in St. Louis. And what our hyper-fragmented system of governance enabled is basically the sorting of people by class, which means by race. We have very strong racial patterns in terms of where people are able to live. And each of these little municipalities has all kinds of governance powers, including the power to raise taxes and spend them on their residents only. So one of the ways that racism lives on is through what we tend to think of as a kind of structural racism, through institutions like institutions of governance and economic institutions. So I think that you're right in a way to say it's in St. Louis's DNA, as long as we understand DNA to mean, to be sort of a metaphor for our institutions.
So is this incident then, which is ongoing, over the shooting of Michael Brown back in August and the non-indictment of the police officer who shot him, shot 12 shots, six of which struck him in the front, and his narrative, the policeman's narrative, was able to shape the grand jury's decision. He was able to testify, and now he's gone on national television. And as I've suggested, you know, a good percentage of the country believe that to be the official story, when a lot of people, me included, just find the story absolutely incomprehensible, and that there's clearly another narrative that's trying to be buried here. And that has led people to be frustrated and outraged and to express their outrage on the streets, none of which is particularly helpful. I mean, we had a demonstration here in Los Angeles last night where they shut down the freeway, you know, which is not exactly the way to win hearts and minds, but welcome to angry, divided America.
Right. Well, you know, I used to think that about the highway shutdowns. I agree. I draw the line at violence. But I used to think, you know, why shut down the highway? But I think I understand the tactic better now, and I'm more sympathetic to it. The point is to disrupt the normal functioning of these cities that are perpetuating these inequalities. And I think that the highway shutdowns have actually helped draw enormous amounts of attention to the protests themselves. Do they win hearts and minds? I think that what the protesters who are participating in shutting down the freeways would say is no, but they get an issue on the agenda. So for so long, one of the issues with structural racism, which we were just talking about, is that many people think we have a colorblind state, everything is fine. And I think that the enormous disruptive protests that a big part of what they're trying to do is to interrupt, you know, that kind of complacency and that kind of narrative and say, no, there's a problem. You know, we're angry. Our anger is justified. And we think the system is corrupt. So I do think there's a message there. And I guess that I would really separate the disruptive, nonviolent protests from things like looting and arson, which I do believe are counterproductive.
Well, Clarissa Heywood, I thank you very much for joining us here today. And I hope in the future we can have a conversation that is more optimistic and healing. But at this point, there's not a lot to be thankful for on this Thanksgiving.
I hope so.
Again, I've been speaking with Clarissa Heywood, who is a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis, whose research and teaching focuses on questions central to understanding and evaluating political life. She's the author of How Americans Make Race. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the provocative actions taken by Vladimir Putin to bait the West into a military incident.
Mother's arms is murder. New absence in a mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn. Overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. Shell shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs, and the soul eased out of the slums, and the voice eased out of the drums, the sirens.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kimberly Martin, who's a professor of political science at Barnard College and a member of the Columbia University's Harriman Institute and Saltzman Institute for War and Peace. Her books include Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory and Soviet Military Innovation, and her latest, Warlords, Strong-Arm Brokers in Weak States. She has an article at the Huffington Post, Don't Prop Up Putin by Giving Him an Enemy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kimberly Martin.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be back.
And Kimberly, it seems to me that there's always been a contradiction, or at least an apparent inability, for a lot of people to keep two thoughts in their head at the same time. And one is that NATO expansion towards Russia heading east has not been necessarily a good idea and has had unfortunate consequences in feeding Russian paranoia. But on the other hand, Putin is, and the Siloviki, the former intelligence officers and oligarchs surrounding him, are essentially stealing the country blind and using the bogus fear of NATO and the Ukrainian incident as a way to cover up this wholesale theft. So, you know, it's as though, you know, people somehow, I mean, those two things aren't mutually exclusive, in other words. What's your thoughts on that?
You've just given a great introduction to my current research project, which is on the question of what would have happened if NATO hadn't expanded. And what I'm learning is a couple things. First, it was inevitable, probably, that NATO would expand. It didn't have to necessarily expand exactly when it did or exactly how it did. But there was eventual agreement among both leaders in the Democratic Party and leaders in the Republican Party in the United States that NATO needed to do something to keep sort of the liberal world order in place in the new system. And so eventually it would have grown larger. And so, you know, there's another issue as well, which is that what really humiliated and disappointed Russia was not so much NATO expansion as an individual act that came as part of a whole system where Russia is really dealing with the end of empire and the collapse of the empire. And we know from other situations around the globe and throughout history that when that happens, it's always easiest to blame the former opponent as being, you know, the person that is causing your troubles. So, yes, NATO expansion has been a terrible irritant for Russia, and Putin has done as much as he could to play it up. It could have perhaps gone more slowly. It could have been done in a way that did more to perhaps include Russian concerns. But, you know, in the 1990s, there was a real effort that was led by Strobe Talbot in the United States to reach out to Russia and to give Russia a special role in what was happening with NATO. And when it comes down to the reality of politics, I'm not sure that things could have gone all that differently, but there maybe could have been more reassurance.
But Gorbachev himself, at the recent 25th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down, revisited his sense of betrayal that he thought he had a deal with President Bush, the first president, Shevardnadze, and Baker also had a deal. So, and that was that, in effect, the former Warsaw Pact would be kind of a neutral zone. How does that factor in your research?
Okay, I've looked at the history greatly, and that's actually not what Gorbachev said. What Gorbachev said is that there was no explicit promise about NATO expansion, and he never believed that there was one, but he was disappointed that Soviet and Russian interests weren't taken more seriously. So what happened in 1990 with the meeting with Baker, at that point the Warsaw Pact still existed, and nobody was talking about the Warsaw Pact not existing. The purpose of that meeting was to talk about reunification of Germany. And so when Baker made the statement about NATO not expanding to the east, the first thing to keep in mind is that what he was talking about is the expansion of military forces on German territory to go from West Germany into East Germany. The second thing to remember is that that was only the first round of negotiations, and at that point in the spring of 1990, Gorbachev did not accept the proposal that Baker was putting forward, and so the negotiations were stopped for several months, and then they were restarted again in the fall. So there was never a sense that anything that Baker would have said in the spring was some kind of a standing deal that was still present in the fall. The negotiations started over again. On the point of Gorbachev in particular, it's kind of silly to think that the Soviets would ever have believed that an oral promise was binding. They did a really good job throughout the Cold War of engaging in very long negotiations over every written piece of word that ever appeared in any kind of an arms control negotiation. They were not people who took oral promises and believed that that was what was happening. So the whole debate that has been in the popular press in the last few months about whether there was an oral promise made in March of 1990 that bound NATO to not expand in the future is really kind of off base. The real question is, could the United States, could the NATO members have done more to reassure the Soviet Union and to reassure Russia that they were still taken seriously? There was never any belief by anybody that an oral statement made in March of 1990 by James Baker committed NATO to never expanding in the future.
Well, of course, that just to go back a little bit further into the Cold War, there was always a central paradox that NATO's security depended upon Warsaw Pact stability. And now that we know what a house of cards the Warsaw Pact was and how much the Russians were afraid that the Polish army might turn on them, it's a sort of miracle that we got through that period, don't you think?
I think everybody is very lucky that in 1989 and 1990 in Eastern Europe, we didn't have the kind of situation that might have happened. Mary Cerati, a historian from the University of Southern California, who's currently at Harvard University for this year as a visiting professor, has written about the fact that it could have been a Tiananmen Square situation in Europe, that the police forces, especially in East Germany, came very close to ordering an out-and-out attack against protesters, especially in Leipzig in 1989. And so, yeah, I think you're right that we are very lucky that the Warsaw Pact fell apart peacefully and that the wall came down peacefully, and it didn't necessarily have to happen that way. And in that case, a lot of credit goes to Gorbachev, because he was the one who really made the decision that he did not want force to be used, and he communicated that very, very strongly to the counterparts in places like East Germany.
And Putin, of course, was in Leipzig.
Yeah, he was. He was burning the documents as the wall fell.
Wow. Again, I'm speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's a professor of political science at Barnard College and a member of Columbia University's Harriman Institute and the Saltzman Institute for War and Peace. Her books include Weapons, Culture and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory and Soviet Military Innovation, and her latest, Warlords, Strong-Armed Brokers in Weak States. She has an article at the Huffington Post, Don't Prop Up Putin by Giving Him an Enemy. So let's get into your article at the Huffington Post, which I think, Kimberly, is an extremely important article, because it seems pretty obvious that Putin needs the Western enemy. He has gendered up and turned NATO into this. And I honestly believe, from what I understand, people who know him, because of his background in the KGB as a somewhat minor KGB figure, that he still sort of, in many ways, believes that because the KGB runs Russia, or the SVR runs Russia and the FSB under him, the same's happening in the United States. And I don't know whether, you know, he's using this for propaganda purposes, or he honestly believes that this whole revolution counter-revolution in Ukraine was done by the CIA, which he said in many of his speeches. So let's start with that. Is the guy delusional or cynical, or both?
I think it's really hard to know. And the interesting thing was the article that was released just, I think it was yesterday or the day before, the interview that was done with Putin, this very wide-ranging interview by a Russian press source. And, you have to figure that anything that Putin does that is a media appearance is something that is planned, so it must have some sense of purpose behind it. And yet when you read this thing, it's really hard to figure out what exactly Putin had in mind. He rambles himself. He talks about whether or not he's a lonely person and whether or not the people who have been sanctioned are actually people that he meets with on a regular basis. He talks about, you know, whether he has health problems or not. He talks about whether he will run for the presidency at the next election in 2018 or not. I mean, it's just sort of, it's wide-ranging, and it seems to be all focused on him, but it doesn't seem to be sending a clear message about himself. So I think it's really an open question whether or not he is the same person he was a few years ago.
Well, I've heard that from some intelligence sources, that there's some people that are concerned that he may be going off the deep end. So
that's what Angela Merkel said, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I think is, you know, it's bad enough having the conversation we're having, but if that's true, then God knows what we can do. But let's just talk about what he is doing now. And,
okay.
and that is clearly pushing the envelope and trying to provoke the West with these buzzing.
It's incredible. And the thing that nobody can figure out is that this is focused not only on the United States, but on Europe. And, you know, during the Soviet era, one of the strategies that the Soviet Union used regularly was trying to separate out Europe from the United States and to try to draw divisions between them. And instead, he seems to just be drawing the United States and Europe together. And then the really odd thing is that he's been doing threatening moves towards Finland and Sweden, which are not part of NATO. And it's making the leaders in those countries think more and more about whether they actually want to join NATO to get the protection of being under the NATO umbrella. So you'd think that if he were being rational, he would be trying to say to Finland and Sweden, won't you be my friends at this time of crisis, rather than pushing them into the arms of people that he is trying to make his enemies.
And some of his Putin's Air Force came so close to a Swedish passenger, a jetliner, that it almost crashed. They've been buzzing NATO facilities. They're patrolling the Gulf of Mexico. So it does look as though he's shopping for an incident.
Yeah, it really does look like that, and that I think that that's frightening in and of itself. I'm very heartened to see. I think it was a week ago that there was an interview of some retired U.S. Air Force officers who all agreed that, you know, the result, the response from the United States should just be to be very calm and sort of to keep a peaceful kind of atmosphere as much as possible. So I guess I have a fair amount of confidence that it's not very likely to escalate into something direct immediately. But, you know, my big concern is that it looks now that the Republicans have taken over the Congress again starting in January, that they're going to push through two pieces of legislation that would mandate that the United States sell lethal weaponry to Ukraine. And I'm really concerned about what that would mean, because I think, you know, given this current situation, given Putin's mindset, if there was credible evidence that a so-called Russian volunteer who was fighting in Ukraine were to be killed by a weapon that could be identified as a U.S. weapon, that would just give him an excuse to ratchet it up further and do something much more direct to threaten the United States.
Well, as you point out in your article at the Huffington Post, Kimberly Martin, don't prop up Putin by giving him an enemy. What Putin has succeeded, in quotes, doing in Ukraine is, in effect, and in Crimea, is taking on an economic basket case and a ruined economy and a devastated country with, you know, places starting to look like Syria with all the buildings with pockmarks from shells and bullets, etc. So he would like to be able to, already he's had an enormous propaganda success. The Russian people are living in a bubble of delusion that he has created. So why give them real evidence? So far, phony evidence has been sufficient. And somehow he's dodged the bullet of shooting down that, or being responsible for shooting down that Malaysian airliner. So I find it extraordinary to think that John McCain and Lindsey Graham are going to be start, you know, thumping their chests and calling to stand up to this guy, when clearly the smart and subtle thing to do is to let him twist in the wind until he finally comes to his senses.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, the other disturbing thing that's happened just in the past few days is that Putin has now announced a new military agreement with Abkhazia, one of the breakaway areas in Georgia that the Russian troops took over in 2008 when they had the war with Georgia. And they're now going to have a joint military, Abkhazian military, so that they're under the same security framework. And a lot of people believe that what's happening is that Russia is expanding again, that now they're going to take over Abkhazia as being a new part of Russian territory. You know, it's just sort of, it's happening everywhere. It's really disturbing. And of course, John McCain was always somebody who was very fond of the notion that Georgia should join NATO, and he also wanted Ukraine to join NATO. And I don't think that there's much chance of that happening, because he wouldn't have the ability to just do that by fiat. And I don't think the European members of NATO have any interest in having Ukraine or Georgia as future members. But nonetheless, the rhetoric is just, there's no question that it's ratcheting up, and the policy could be following it. A lot of people are also predicting that when the new Congress comes in, they are going to make the sanctions law. Right now, the sanctions are an executive order, which means that they can be lifted or changed at the will of the president without having to go through a vote. If they became law, then at that point, it would need a congressional vote to lift the sanctions. And the sanctions would essentially take on the role that the Jackson-Vanik Act had throughout the Cold War, where every year there'd be a vote in the Congress about how the Soviet Union was doing on its responsibilities and whether trade could be resumed.
Well, Kimberly Martin, it would seem there that the current approach, notwithstanding that we haven't been clear about NATO expansion and haven't been able to, show our soft underbelly in any way that satisfies Putin, but what I think is biting him is the fact that the oil prices are dropping so precipitously. Apparently, they're short $100 billion now in terms of their budget.
Yeah. And their economy is completely dependent on oil.
Likewise, the same is happening with Iran. It's obvious that both Iran and Russia are being pressured by these low oil prices, which apparently are going to get even lower. And this obviously gets to him when you go after his money and the Siloviki's money, because that seems to, I don't understand why this guy supposedly has something like $80 billion stashed in Switzerland. Given the sanctions against him and the Leningrad Bank and all this stuff, is he getting the message, do you think?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question, and my understanding is from the latest news reports that OPEC just had a meeting, and they announced to Russia that they have no intention of restraining their production to make the oil prices rise again. Russia had been hoping that they could get some kind of an agreement with Saudi Arabia, and OPEC said no. At least that's the latest news report. So the oil prices are going to stay low for a good long time, it looks like. There's a theory there that says that causes autocratic regimes to ease up, that they can only have, very firm policies towards their citizens in terms of clamping down against human rights and freedom of expression when oil prices are high, because when oil prices are low, they need the support of citizens to stay in power. So I think that this is a year or two coming ahead of us where things might be really very much in flux in Russia, but I don't know what that means, and I don't think anybody knows what it means. I think it would be a mistake to believe that a threat to the Putin regime is necessarily going to lead to democracy. So I think that we are really entering an era of instability and uncertainty where we don't really know what's coming next. I think it's always possible that, if you make Putin feel cornered and feel like he doesn't have any choice, he may become even angrier and even more aggressive.
And it's possible that maybe it's the Russian people will go along with austerity in the name of foreign aggression, go back to
they're
that Cold War mentality that they're...
They're used to it. And it always amazed me over the last few years that the Russian population, including the younger population, seems to be accepting what they're hearing from Russian state media, because you would think that people in Russia would have that knowledge that in the past the media really tried to pull one over on them, and that they wouldn't believe what they're hearing from the state. But it doesn't seem to be happening, that they are accepting what the state is telling them. And so maybe what will happen is that they will fall into the old Soviet cultural pattern of just accepting what the state tells them about foreign threats, and therefore accepting, you know, the need for austerity, as you said. A lot of the more reformist types who were associated maybe with Medvedev rather than being associated with Putin have been saying that they think that the sanctions actually created a way for Putin to take the blame off himself, because the Russian economy was already going downhill because of corruption, because of the falling oil prices. And now Putin can blame everything on the sanctions, even though the sanctions aren't really what's causing the major part of the problem.
But just in closing, Kimberly Martin, if the Russian people accept and believe the propaganda that Putin's state media is pumping out, that would suggest to me that there is a collective sense of national humiliation.
There is no question there is one.
So how do you overcome that and indicate to the Russian people that you're not out to get them when Putin's telling them that we are out to get them?
I think it's probably too late for that. The reset failed miserably. So the attempt at that point to early in the Obama administration to reach out to Putin didn't have any staying power whatsoever. He just took advantage of everything that he could. So I think it's too late to overcome it. But my biggest concern is that we try very hard not to make it worse. And I think that by sending weapons to Ukraine, that would be about the worst thing that we could do in terms of really creating this image of the United States as being an enemy that wants to get Russia and wants to put Russia down.
Well, Kimberly Martin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's a professor of political science at Barnard College and a member of Columbia University's Harriman Institute and the Saltzman Institute for War and Peace. Her books include Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory, and Soviet Military Innovation, and her latest, Warlords, Strong Arm Brokers in Weak States. She has an article at the Huffington Post, Don't Prop Up Putin by Giving Him an Enemy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the $400 billion in permanent tax breaks the Republicans are planning to give corporate America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rebecca Smith, who is the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, where she focuses on international human and labor rights, immigrants and work, enforcement of workplace standards and unemployment insurance. And she's testified before Congress and several state legislatures on these issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Smith.
Thanks very much, Ian. It's always a pleasure.
And on this Thanksgiving holiday, of course, working Americans are sitting around the table with their families, along with middle-class Americans, and we've just learning in Wednesday's New York Times that President Obama is threatening to veto a $440 billion tax deal that's been negotiated between the Republicans and the outgoing Majority Leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, that would give permanent tax breaks for businesses worth $440 billion over 10 years while leaving out working families and the middle class. And this, of course, is a direct result of the last elections. So do you expect that we're heading into a period where the middle class and working Americans will have less to be thankful for?
We may well, although that has been something that's been going on for the last 40 years. I mean, we've seen the greatest wealth accumulation at the very top in the history of the United States, with that top 1% increasing their wealth by about 300%, and of course the rest of us not so much, losing ground or seeing our wages stagnate.
And what explains that? One of the most alarming statistics that I've ever seen is the fact that the Walmart heirs, the five children of the founder of Walmart, Sam Walton, who essentially just, you know, are accidents of birth, they inherited this company. It's one of the richest in the world. And between them, their aggregated wealth of the heirs of Walmart, that their wealth is equal to the bottom 40% of all Americans. And yet the people that work for them at Walmart don't make a living wage. And they're, you know, I'm not sure what kind of Thanksgiving they're having, but it's certainly, you know, the Walton heirs have enough money to give everybody on this planet a Thanksgiving feast, and they'd still have billions left over.
Yeah. Well, some of the Walmart workers, of course, are working on Thanksgiving Day, and not only Walmart, but other major retailers like Target and Kmart and Toys R Us are also open on Thanksgiving in the hopes that they can get a jump on the Black Friday sales. So some Walmart workers are working. Other Walmart workers are striking. We're seeing today walkouts in Virginia and in D.C. and in 12 states across the country of Walmart workers protesting retaliation for against them when they try to organize, and really highlighting that Walmart workers themselves are among the hungriest of Americans. And that's an astonishing, striking occurrence for people who are celebrating Thanksgiving, and we're supposed to be celebrating the bounty that we enjoy. Many, many of us don't enjoy that bounty.
Again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Smith, who is the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, where she focuses on international human and labor rights, immigrants and work, enforcement of workplace standards and unemployment insurance, and has testified before Congress and several state legislatures on these issues. So why do you think, though, that we aren't having a national debate about economic fairness? I know the president tried to introduce that about a year ago in a speech, the same spot where Teddy Roosevelt, the famous progressive, delivered a similar message about economic fairness. And, of course, that was in the back in the Gilded Age, and now arguably we're in a new Gilded Age. Yet I don't feel that the outrage, for example, of the Walton family having so much money at the expense of the people who work for them, who they don't pay a living wage, and it's one of the biggest employers in the country. And as a result, the taxpayer has to make up the difference with food stamps and health care. And this is so outrageous that even libertarians find this unsupportable, that they believe that the Walmart should pay a living wage, because they don't believe that the taxpayer should be forced to make up the difference.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, for living in the greatest wealth accumulation since the Gilded Age, I think we're also seeing some of the most widespread labor actions since the 1930s, with the fast food workers' strike then joined by home care, and now Walmart workers who have often walked out on Black Friday, walking out again this Black Friday. So I think there is resistance from workers, and I see some hope in the power that workers have amassed and in the common sense of the American people, in that in this last election, when Democrats lost so much ground, the real winners were low-wage workers when voters voted for minimum wage increases in four states. And, you know, these aren't the typical blue states that you would expect to raise wages, places like South Dakota and Alaska. So I think that many, many Americans, workers and voters alike, are starting to make changes that will perhaps take some steps towards lessening inequality in this country. There's a survey out there of about what Americans think inequality is in this country and what kind of equality they would like to see. And it's really astonishing but also heartening that we do want to see differences. Americans were willing to say the top 20% should have 25% of the country's wealth, but not the astounding percent of the country's wealth that they have now.
So
cause for hope.
What is the astounding percentage?
The top 20% now has 80%+ of the wealth in this country.
So, Rebecca Smith, the last elections, as I just pointed out earlier in our conversation, we're already seeing the consequences of the last election, where the House Republicans are negotiating a tax break for big business of $440 billion over 10 years. And this is money that we don't have. So this will be deficit spending. At the same time, working Americans and middle-class Americans are getting nothing. And we've had a recovery of sorts where jobs are back, but wages aren't. And this last election, it was the lowest turnout in over 70 years. And the people who may well have benefited from voting didn't vote. And as you pointed out, those that did vote, who were largely conservative because the conservatives won that election, nevertheless did vote for a minimum wage increase. So that would indicate to me that if working Americans showed up to vote, they'd get more benefits. So what explains that disconnect?
Well, I think partly for midterm elections, there's always a lower turnout, and it's always more traditional, older, whiter Republican voters who go to the polls in midterm elections. So I think that's part of what explains the low turnout. And I think, frankly, we've created a world in which those, our children and other millennials, are kind of disgusted with what is happening in Congress and aren't seeing that anyone has a message that they can buy into and that anyone is trying to deliver for them the basic living standards that we all agree that we all merit, and just by virtue of being human beings and workers. So I think that's part of the reason for the lower turnout.
But
for the votes in favor of minimum wage, everyone gets that. Across the political spectrum, people understand, as the workers' slogan goes, that you can't survive on $7.25. So come January, we're going to have higher minimum wages in 29 states and the District of Columbia than the federal minimum wage. And I think that's a message to whatever Congress is in charge in 2015 that they need to get on that wagon and raise minimum wages.
But in this last election, Rebecca Smith, we saw a record spending, much of which came from people like the Koch brothers and other wealthy and corporate interests. And because of the Supreme Court's decision on campaign finance, much of the spending was what they call dark money. It was unattributed which then allows corporations to spend money without offending their customers who may not agree with their political stance. And as we've mentioned, this $400 billion in tax breaks for corporate America that the Republicans are now negotiating, permanent tax breaks for 10 years, would indicate, well, permanent tax breaks, but they're worth $440 billion over 10 years. This would indicate that this is how what happens. If you buy an election, you get your payback. So why doesn't the same apply on the political left? I don't mean the left can't buy an election, but they do have the numbers. They may not have the money, but they have the numbers. So that, to me, is still a puzzlement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we need to inspire more young, non-traditional voters. And I think we're starting to do that, but more of that is needed. It's really tough when you are outspent, as the political left is, by so many times by the political right. And this is kind of all part of the same picture. Corporations are making huge profits while wages stagnate. They can put that money into elections and then elect the people who will perpetuate or worsen that inequality.
So in terms of inspiration, clearly it's not happening. Is there anybody that you know or any movement that you know that could inspire millennials and others to start participating in governance and in civic life?
There are a number of groups out there, and because I work mainly with workers' groups, I think the worker center movement around the country, made up generally of young, energized activists, they're making change. I think the group of dreamers, many of whom got deferred action in President Obama's action a couple of years ago on immigration, they inspire me as well. Groups of young activists who see what is happening and are trying to make changes.
So on this Thanksgiving holiday, you feel there is something to be thankful for in terms of hope for change? I don't mean to be ironic in terms of the 2008 presidential campaign of Barack Obama, but clearly a lot of people feel disappointed and have turned to cynicism. And it's difficult not to be cynical, particularly after what just happened in Ferguson with a rigged grand jury that produced such outrageous results, which obviously make people feel that the system is rigged against them and sink into despair, if not into irrational violence.
I think there is. As bad as things are, I think American people are waking up, and I think American workers are starting to organize in whatever way makes most sense to them, whether it's around policies or whether it's to confront their employer and demand better wages and working conditions. I think the tide is turning, and I hope that next year if we have this conversation, I'll be able to report more hopeful changes.
Well, I'm with you on that, and I thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca Smith.
Thank you, Ian. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Bye.
Bye. And again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Smith, who is the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, where she focuses on international human and labor rights, immigrants and work, enforcement of workplace standards, and unemployment insurance, and has testified before Congress and several state legislatures on these issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.